Blog Talk Radio.
What is that?
I don't know. It's kind of catchy, you know. What was that? I think.
Did you hear? It's like disco music.
It was very much like disco music. What was all that about, man?
This is Movie Geeks United, by the way. That's our opening theme. I press play on the opening theme, and this is what comes up. Oh, for some reason.
Oh, now it comes up.
For some reason, I press play on it, and disc like club music came on.
Dude, man, it's Ghost in the Machine, dude.
All right, let's try this again. Blog Talk Radio. Now that's an opening.
That is an opening. You should be thankful that's what you got.
You can't open a show without an opening.
Yeah, you can't open it like that. What was that just played, man? Like outtakes from Saturday Night Fever or something? Or
I don't know what that was. It was like a scene from.
Up, man.
I think it's the soundtrack to the club scene in The Hard Way. That's my.
There's your Hard Way reference for the week, folks. Just deal with it.
The Party Crasher, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm terrific. Never better.
It's awesome. All right. Cool. All right. On that note, folks, we're gonna go forward with our show. So what's going on, man? What's up?
Not a lot. You know, I saw this movie yesterday. This Disgrace with it wasn't a disgrace. The movie. It's called Disgrace with John Malkovich.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see that. I want to see that. You know, I'm looking forward to that. So,
it's very good role for him.
Mm-hmm.
A very complicated, unapologetic, morally.
It's about South Africa, right?
Not really. I mean, he
sleeps
with. Well,
no, it takes place in South Africa, though, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's written by a very famous South African writer, J.M. Coetzee.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It's not about any issues.
Oh no, not like that. No.
But he's a teacher and he sleeps with an underage student and he has no remorse or feeling about it one way or another. And then he kind of goes and starts another life. It's interesting. You have no idea where it's going. And Malkovich is the perfect cerebral kind of actor to play a part like
yeah,
that.
I mean, he's definitely all about that. So, I mean, he's good.
Which I don't know. I don't know how cerebral will come in the comic book movie that he's about to do.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's... oh, my God.
Isn't he in Spider-Man 4?
I think he's going to be in the Spider-Man reboot. I really do.
And what was role?
I think it was originally the Vulture or something, but I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know, because since they rebooted the whole thing, I don't know if any of that's... but he's in Transformers 3.
Right.
And I don't... I don't know if that helps things out or not. I mean, I'd rather just go back and watch The Object of Beauty again or, you know...
Yeah. That's the way they transform a great career into a crappy one. That's what
Because I don't even think
be.
He can save that, you know? I don't even think...
I never watch a Transformers movie and think, you know what, this movie can need some Malkovich.
Yeah,
could use some Malkovich.
Not the first thing that comes to mind. I'm sure it's not the first thing. He might even, when he gets to set, what the hell are Transformers? I mean,
right.
He'd be like, what the...
But he did Con Air.
I know, he did Con Air, but he'd still be, who the hell is this kid here? Who is this? Hey, get me a soda. Thanks. All right. You know?
Well, you know, and I love it how everybody says, well, people didn't get Con Air. It's a... It's a takeoff. It's a spoof of sorts on the overblown action movie. It's just another overblown action
movie. I like Con Air. Wrong, but I like. Did someone actually say takeoff? That was like a pun or something there, a takeoff? That was
all me. I'm sorry.
That was good, man. That was good. I mean,
so, and there was another great actor that was signed on for Transformers 3. It was announced.
I forgot. I know. There is someone else. There is a veteran actor who is, I forgot. It went right over
female.
My head.
It's a female. We'll look it up. We'll look it up right here. But we won't.
Bonnie Bedelia?
I like Bonnie Bedelia.
That was the first name that came to mind.
Man, Presumed Innocent, I've had a thing for Bonnie Bedelia. She is, like, my type. She's all, you know, I was like, you can kill my, you can kill my affair anytime.
Yeah, the Heart Like a Wheel tribute show is coming up soon.
Transformers 3.
Does it have a title yet? Like, Optimus Prime goes down on Megatron or something? I mean, what?
Megan Fox, that is not the actress. Frances McDormand.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. And Dean in the chat room, he called it.
Did he?
Yeah, he called it. Yeah, I just checked in the chat room. Way to go, Dean. I hope things aren't tight at home. I mean, you know, I hope. Wow.
Anyway, that's something to look forward to. I always like to open a show talking about Transformers.
I know. I'm camping out, man. Hell, get my sleeping bag cleaned up. You know, I'm going to be camping out for that shit. All right. What do we got, man? What do we got on the thing tonight, man?
Tonight we got a good show with some great conversations. We're going to hear from the screenwriter, if you don't know Jack in a little bit. He's also the screenwriter of Breach, which was
that's
a great
awesome
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has some interesting things to say about what drew him to Kevorkian, his collaboration with Kevorkian and Levinson and Pacino. And then later on, we're going to be hearing from the screenwriters of a new movie. It opens up, I believe, in New York this Friday, New York or in L.A., I think. And it's called Paper Man with Jeff Daniels and Ryan Reynolds and Lisa Kudrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a good movie. And the screenwriters, Kieran and Michelle Mulroney, they're married, so there's an interesting conversation there about how that works.
Right, of course.
And also, they got the gig to write the sequel to Sherlock Holmes for Guy Ritchie, so we talked
a
little bit about
that. Well, that's always a good gig to get, yeah.
Yeah, and then we got a couple of film scores to get to and some movie news. Hey, we didn't mention this Sunday, but it happened Sunday. D.D. Allen passed.
Yeah, I know. That was probably the biggest story, and we didn't cover it, but I don't think we knew yet. That's a huge loss. That's a big hole right there in the cinematic universe that's going to be impossible to fill as far as I'm concerned. You just don't really – that's a turning point. That's a major seismic shift in cinematic editing, just in filmmaking in general.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't.
Dee Allen, for those that are unacclimated out there, she's the legendary film editor, and her legendary status was kind of set in stone 40 years ago with Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is just astounding, and it's kind of using the aesthetics of the European cinema and bringing them to an American cinema. I mean, in a classically American cinema too. The young outlaw, bank robbers kind of thing, Midwestern,
right.
And applying those techniques to that film, and I think it changed movies. You know, a lot of people note something like Easy Rider, but you go year before, it's Bonnie and Clyde that changed movies and kind of ushered in a new era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde's really one of those turning points, you know, major turning points in American cinema. There's no denying that.
Reds. She edited Reds.
Dean's made Reds and Dog Day Afternoon and
Serpico.
You know, these are all really, really important, timeless films that have held up very well. And thanks to you really realize where the editing is like the vital, intrinsic thing to a successful movie, and those films really demonstrate that to its fullest.
Yeah. You gonna see You Don't Know Jack on Sunday when it airs on HBO?
I thought it aired on Saturday.
The Saturday. Did I say
Sunday?
Yeah,
I want to definitely see that on. Yeah, I want to check that out. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I meant to say Saturday. It airs on the 24th. Airs on the 24th, 9 p.m. I believe on HBO. And I gave my review of it the last show. It's terrific, and especially if you're a fan of great acting, watch
course.
It for Pacino.
But he, you think he's really good here. He's not just doing his usual shtick. I mean, this is real.
What?
You know, exactly. You sound like one of my
What did bosses. You say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, usual shtick. I'll let that comment fly.
You're
I know what you're
let
saying.
It fly. You know
I know what
you're
saying.
Who you be the first to admit it, so...
Well, he is. This is one of his top 10. And this performance belongs on his top 10.
All right.
And I made a statement that when you think of Jack Kevorkian after seeing this movie, that you'll see Pacino's face. Which is a great compliment for his performance, I think.
Right, okay.
So let's get to our first interview. Adam Mazur, who is the screenwriter of You Don't Know Jack. He's also the screenwriter of Breach, as we mentioned before, which
mm-hmm.
was from 2 years ago, I think. It was
That's
the
2007,
best.
I believe, yeah. Or 2008,
yeah.
2007 or 2008, yeah.
It was one of my favorite movies that year.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And really because it dealt with a complicated central character, and Kevorkian fits that same bill.
Yeah.
And that's where our conversation starts. Here's Adam Mazur.
Very rarely do you find something you just say, I want to play this.
You may call it mercy killing. I call it a medical service for an incurably suffering patient.
You see Kevorkian with all his faults, and you see him with all his eccentricities and his huge ego.
When a law is deemed immoral by you, you must disobey it.
This is about real people, and it's based on real things that happened.
They went to Dr. Kevorkian because they felt that whatever the end of life would come, he would be there to support it, and nothing would go wrong. You could stop right now. You wouldn't offend me. You try to find a way to express what I feel it is to be a zealot.
Who cares what people think? It's what my patient feels.
Because it's so extreme and because we're so fearful, it just lends itself to humor.
It'll be your own field of specialty, Jack. You're going to need some business cards, you know?
Al has a sweetness about him that I never knew firsthand. I think he brings to him a warmth that maybe wasn't very obvious.
You know, I don't get many visitors up here, women especially.
With your charms, I'm shocked.
It just keeps unfolding. And it doesn't feel like it's taking a stand on one thing or another.
Have the gall to charge Dr. Kevorkian tonight. Bring it on.
You're not a local quack anymore.
No, no.
You're America's quack.
America's quack.
It's a very eclectic kind of movie.
It's funny to see him, and kind of tragic to see him, try to succeed and be his own worst enemy.
People that you can trust. And the only way people trust.
He is outrageous and doesn't care about anything except what he cares about.
He's the real thing. And you rarely come across the real thing.
Seeing your other major credit in terms of screenwriting, Breach.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What struck me about it, and by the way, Breach was one of my very favorite movies the year it was released as well.
Oh, great. Thanks.
It both of these kind of deal with enigmatic central characters. Is that a personality trait that particularly fascinates you?
Well, I'm definitely drawn to, you know, the complicated characters. You know, probably a little bit more men than women, per se. But yeah, but definitely that's always been something I've. You know, try to, yeah, I've just been attracted to, yeah, you know, Robert Hansen, you know, of course, was such a complicated guy and mm-hmm. you know, like you said, an enigmatic person and you know, after interviewing, you know, other FBI agents and people that knew him and so many that, you know, had no concept, you know, they were just clueless about any, you know, of course, what he was doing you know, and Kevorkian, the same way, you know, is just such an iconic figure who, you know, trying to get under the skin of him especially, and, you know, and Hansen as well, you know, are just such a great, you know, challenge, you know, to a writer to, you know, to try to, you know, sort of try to crack these guys.
Well, I know that you probably ask this question a lot in the interviews that I've seen around the time of Breach's release. The main question was, why did Hansen do what he did? And was it important to you as a screenwriter to find reasons for that, or was the drama in who knows why he did what he did?
You know, for Hansen, it was the journey of trying to find the answer to why ultimately led to realizing that I don't think there was, you know, one why exactly, you know, which of course everyone wanted that answer. That was, you know, sort of people needed that closure, that resolution. And in fact, you know, there's a scene late in the movie where after he's caught, it's addressed, you know, I think Dennis Haysbert's character sort of, you know, asks him, you know, well, you know, why, and you know, he doesn't really have an answer for it, you know. And so, so starting off in the screenplay and through the research, yes, it felt like it was an important question, you know, to answer. And then as you know, sort of went down the road with it, you know, realized that it was less about answering that question and the why of it all, and just trying to really explore this fascinating character.
I loved it how it didn't simplify it by trying to answer why, as if there could be this one concrete reason for his downfall. That's what I admired most about the movie, actually.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, like I said, that was something that was, you know, I asked more than anything else. Like I said earlier, you know, people just sort of seem to need to know, or that it's a simple equation, you know, of you know, and you know, I think for other spies, you know, historically, you know, had more specific reasons, you know, but this guy, you know, Hansen had a big ego. He wasn't really being listened to in all his years at the FBI. He also had six children and a large family he was trying to support. And so on one hand, you feel like, well, was it for the money? On the other hand, was it ego, getting away with it? You know, actually being on cases where they were looking for spies, and it was really, you know, looking for the spy, and it was really him they were looking for, and
right.
You know, that sort of cat and mouse, and you know, the ego, like I said, the ego of it all with that, you know, and so, I think the big success of that movie too, in my opinion, is, you know, is also that, you know, as a movie, it really, you know, it was, I think, you know, kind of a great character piece, you know, more than anything,
mm-hmm.
too, you
mm-hmm.
know, that, you know, was not, you know, trying to be, you know, the Bourne Identity or something, you know, another kind of spy movie, you know,
exactly.
You know, that probably disappointed some people, because there's a certain expectation that you hear spy movie, you know, and, you know, you have certain expectations about what that's going to be, you know, but, you know, I was so pleased with it, ultimately, how it came out, because it was just about the two guys and the young guy and sort of the would-be mentor, you know, and you know, bringing him down and, you know, getting involved in his life in that you know, 2 or 3 month span that the movie covers.
You're being tasked to headquarters, where you'll be riding the desk of an agent named Robert Hansen, considered our most knowledgeable analyst on Russian intel. He's also a sexual deviant. This could mean a huge embarrassment to the Bureau. You're going to keep an eye on him for us.
Tell me 5 things about yourself, 4 of them true.
I don't think I'd be much good at bluffing.
That would have counted as your lie right there.
Is there anything you can tell me about him?
Sure.
Take nothing personally.
You know why the Soviet Empire collapsed?
Good morning.
Godlessness.
God expects you to live your faith, Eric, at all times.
I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking for. The guy doesn't drink, goes to church every day.
Faith, family, country. Those are the things that matter.
Come to admire him, I think.
Yes.
Respect him?
I never cared about making headlines. Wanted to make history.
He's a traitor, Eric. Started spying for the Russians in 1985. Good news is you're in the middle of the biggest case we've ever run. The damage he's done to the U.S. government is in the billions. might be years before we truly know how many deaths he's been responsible for.
Why don't we just arrest him?
Can't do that. Director wants him caught in the act.
What if he's smarter than I am?
He spent the last 20 years outthinking Russian spies. He's smarter than all of us.
Have you been in my briefcase?
No.
Don't like being scrutinized. Have to do something about that.
He's parked outside your apartment.
Where were you?
I'm telling so many lies now, I can't keep them straight anymore.
Are you finding this job stressful?
Sometimes.
Pray more.
He knows the names of every source we've ever turned. Their lives are all at risk.
I need to know if I can trust you.
What are you doing?
Who is calling you in the car?
Put the gun down.
I need to know if I can trust you.
Well, I think it's one of the great movies of the past few years, and I tout it all the time on the show. So I'm a big fan of that.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thanks.
Kevorkian is similarly complicated. In watching the movie, it illuminated this aspect of him for me very clearly, in that he does something that most people believe is a very compassionate act, and yet he himself doesn't give off the most openly warm vibe.
Right.
I mean, is that what you found about him, and what did you want to discover about him in the process of writing this?
Well, I do think that he, and he admits, you know, that he's not the most compassionate guy, and I do think that is a you know, the public or a lot of supporters, you know, sort of saw him as that and thought of him as that, you know. But you know what, what you learn about him is, you know, in his experience as a pathologist, which is what his, you know, which is, you know, what his, you know, which is what he was, you know, this was not a guy who ever really, you know, Jack was more of a scientist, really more of a researcher, did a lot of medical experiments, championed, organ donation and blood transfusions and, you know, lots of other, really kind of groundbreaking ideas that, you know, kind of ahead of his time. But, you know, I think with, you know, what you realize about the guy is, you know, he never really learned or had a bedside manner, if you will, because he was never a doctor who saw patients, really, you know. And so he was, you know, he dealt with death, you know, he dealt with death in terms of the human body. So, you know, I think that, you know, that was an interesting thing because I don't think he was, you know, it all came from just having this, you know, huge heart and being this really compassionate guy who wanted to, you know, help people, you know, in their lives. In fact, what really sort of got him into this, which is touched upon in the movie, is that he really saw this, as another way of another avenue for organ donation. That if people, you know, wanted to end their lives who were suffering terribly, that if they had healthy organs, he could harvest those and save lives. You know, and but I think what he quickly found is that a lot of the people who sort of wanted this service or, you know, wanted the ability to you know, die with dignity, you know, they weren't sort of weird as it sounds. I mean, you know, that kind of creeped them out, you know, the idea of organ donation, which is, you know, kind of a tough thing to wrap your head around, but it was sort of true. And I think Susan Sarandon's character in the movie, Janet Good, you know, she tells him that at one point. She says, you know, Jack, you know, it's sort of like one thing at a time here, you know.
Right.
It's a little overwhelming, you know, and almost for that, but that was sort of the bridge of this, you know, because Jack, you know, like I said, championed this for 20, 30 years. You know, he used to go to prisons and sit and talk to death row inmates, and try to convince them to, you know, to offer up their organs, you know, upon their executions, which again, I think was a very sort of logical idea, you know, but you know, seemed too radicalized, and you know, most prison systems, you know, wanted no part of that. But Jack used to say, well, you know, one condemned criminal, you know, could save six lives with half a dozen of his organs, you know. And So it's so that was all very fascinating, you know, because in some ways, you know, the guy that's been known for many years as Dr. Death, really, most of his life was about saving lives, you know,
right.
through his, you know, championing of organ donation and through his the various medical experiments he either conducted or wanted to conduct, or articles that he published about various things. You know, it was all about the saving of lives. So there's a great irony there. But once I met him, you know, I realized, which was, I first met him a few days after he got out of prison back in June of 07. And you know, once I got into his presence, you know, I realized that there was so much more to this guy, you know, and personality-wise as
mm-hmm.
well, you know, than I had any idea.
So was he always, from the moment that you approached him, was he always receptive to the idea of a film based on the latter part of his life?
Well, it's funny, you know, Jack, as you know, you saw in the movie and people see in the movie, is, you know, he's a very, very, you know, simple living man, you know, lived in a tiny apartment in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. He bought his clothes at the Goodwill, you know, $3 sweaters and pants. You know, he had a 68 VW van that he drove. So this is a very, very sort of, you know, sort of simple, you know, kind of humble living man. And, you know, very unimpressed by things. You know, so for many years, the other people had approached him about trying to do a movie on his life. And I just don't think that he ever, you know, it was nothing that, you know, that you know, would get him too excited. And even once we got our project going with HBO, which all started about 3 years ago, you know, he was helpful, you know, and was open to talking, you know, to me and other people involved in making the film, you know, but again, was sort of very, you know, unimpressed by it all. And in fact, until last week when we had our premiere in New York City last week, and Jack, you know, he loved the film and he was very moved by it. He told me he had tears in his eyes more than once, you know, watching the movie. And you know, what was interesting was the other thing he said to me was that he couldn't get excited about it because he just thought that it was just impossible that anyone could capture his story, you know, his life in a 2-hour movie. You know,
right.
So he just was part of it too, I think, for him, was, you know, was like that no one could possibly ever get it right or even get it close. And he was so sort of blown away ultimately by the final product, you know, that you know he was thrilled, you know.
That's true.
That must
be the ultimate compliment for you as a screenwriter then. I mean, to have the subject of your writing have that level of approval.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and like I said, you know, after the premiere and at the sort of after party dinner that HBO had, you know, when he pulled me aside and you know said that to me, especially to, well, you know, both those points, you know, you know, especially when he told me that he had, you know, he cried a couple times, you know, and because it was so important to me, and which I think is, you know, hopefully one of the success of the movie is showing his life somewhat through the point of view of these other characters, the sort of the close circle around him,
right.
His sister, his best friend, his lawyer, you know, a fellow activist, Susan Sarandon's character, and you know, and you know, all those relationships that I knew were so dear to him, because this is a man who didn't have many relationships in his life,
mm-hmm.
or many intimate relationships, or many strong relationships on that level, you know. So especially with like his sister, you know, who passed away in the mid 90s, you know, and you know, and trying to, you know, to do honor to their relationship, you know.
Right.
And I know that was one of the very moving things for him, was watching that portrayed on screen. So that was yeah, I mean, of you know, the accolades we're receiving and things like that, which is all terrific, you know, but to hear that directly from Jack, you know, was I don't know what could be better than that.
Yeah. And speaking of what could be better than that, you have Barry Levinson directing your screenplay. Tell me his relationship with you, and does it continue on set, the conversations that you guys have?
Yes, but you know, Barry was terrific. I mean, you know, clearly a legend in his own right, and has made some of my favorite films. When HBO sent, he was the first director that HBO went after, just knowing he was reading my script, was sort of thrilling in its own right. You know, knowing that you know he's got it, he's reading it, and you're trying not to think too much about that, but. You know, that was, you just can't deny. You're like, wow, this is pretty cool, Hope he likes it and all that. And then, I don't know, it was a week or two later when HBO said, he really responded and he's very interested and he's going to call you, I was at home and I get a call and it's Adam, hey, it's Barry Levinson, he lives back east and I'm here in LA and we had about an hour conversation and he sort of walked through the script a little bit and, was so, gracious and very complimentary about a lot of what was there. And I think he kind of, he really saw what this movie could be and from that point forward, I was on the set for, we shot the movie in New York, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island. It was dubbing from Michigan and Detroit. Mm-hmm. We shot just a few days in Detroit. But I was there probably totally maybe 2/3 of the time. I could have been there the entire time, but living here and I have young kids and everything, I couldn't be gone the entire time. But he was as collaborative as I could have ever dreamed of. I think there was a lot of respect because he knew that I knew the story so well and that I had met these characters, spent a lot of time with these characters. Of course, Jack himself, Neil Nickel, who John Goodman plays in the movie. I spent a lot of time with in Michigan, and knowing Jack for 40 years, was a great resource, and some of the other supporting hot characters and people that I met. So I knew this story backward and forward, and it was, Barry was just so collaborative and was able to to use me for that.
Well, whenever we talk to screenwriters, it always comes up kind of the nightmare of, this is your baby, this is your screenplay, and then you're giving it to a director, you're entrusting the director
right.
to bring it to life. And a lot of screenwriters have horror stories about that, but I would think with Barry Levinson, he seems that he has such respect for the writing of the actors. That's what it's all about in his film. So that's safety for a screenwriter.
I think Barry's a writer first, something a lot of people don't know about him, he started off more in comedy and Barry wrote mm-hmm. for Carol Burnett mm-hmm. and Mel Brooks, the Carol Burnett Show, and then did some early Mel Brooks movies. And so, he would tell me the story, but when he High Anxiety, which he has that great scene in,
right,
where he's
the
bellman, here's your paper. But he said what was great was he co-wrote, he was one of the writers on the script, and that Mel Brooks invited him to the set, and he just couldn't believe that the Mel would let them hang around, and he learned so much. And so I think that I can't speak for all the other movies that he's made where he wasn't the writer, but I feel like he, was, having had that experience himself and having learned so much from that, was so open to, to having, me there, and sort of almost giving back a little bit, I think, in some ways, to that experience, of course there's no, I think some directors, they're maybe a little bit more threatened, or they think that the writer is going to interfere, or they sort of, once they have the script, they don't actually need the body there, but like I said, he was terrific, and very collaborative, right there in between scenes, and there were many moments where Al, would call me over, even without Barry,
I have to ask you about this because I know we're running out of time, so I guess this will be the last question, but Al Pacino has always been my favorite actor, And anyone that listens to the show knows my Pacino obsession. It borders on obsession, really. And I think this is one of his 7 or 8 best performances in You Don't Know Jack. So you have to tell me about that Pacino experience from your point of view. I mean, that's like winning the lottery, too, that Pacino is going to bring your character to life.
Well, you know, just to go back to that story about, you know, when Barry called and we had – so, you know, what happened was, of course, you know, Barry wrote Injustice for All back in, I think it was 1980, and you know, which mm-hmm. Al starred in. And so these guys have known each other for, you know, 30 years. They never worked together again. Barry never directed Al in anything. I think Barry was going to direct Donnie Brasco, mm-hmm. but then chose to do Bugsy instead. So I think Barry's, you know, he's a producer of Donnie Brasco, but – you know, didn't actually direct the movie, and maybe there was might have been one or two other close, you know, close calls for, you know, to do it. But, you know, Barry told me later on that, you know, that he and Al had happened to run into each other not that long before, you know, he read You Don't Know Jack, and so, you know, and they said, oh, you know, when are we finally going to do something together, you know, so, you know, it was sort of, you know, or kismet or whatever, you know, like that they had that conversation just maybe a few weeks before, you know, Barry got the screenplay. So, and then Al was really the first person they gave the script to as well, you know, in terms of to play Jack. So, but yeah, I mean, he, you know, Al, of course, again, like, you know, you're sort of blown away by this opportunity or this, just the idea of it all. And same thing with, like I said, about Barry, when, you know, knowing that Al Pacino was reading the script, you know, it was also another, you know, kind of, you know, incredible, you know, experience.
I bet.
You know, trying to pass the time and, you know, not think about that too much. But I, you know, he too, and I've gotten to, I can say that I've, you know, I know him very well now, and it's such a great experience. And, you know, but he, you know, he too was just, you know, again, so gracious and so, you know, he's such an actor and just all about the material, and he's got there's no aura of anything but just, you know, you know, guy who wants to just, you know, dig into the material and mm-hmm. and there's, you know, he doesn't have walls up, and he's just an amazing guy, you know, and anything, especially you, someone who, you know, who loves this guy and, you know, and admires him. I mean, I can honestly say, you know, he's everything you could hope, you know, he would be. And you know, as I said, during as his process, you know, we had a few readings of the screenplay, you know, prior to shooting, and you know, you could just see how, you know, him doing the work and, you know, trying to find a voice, trying to find inflections, trying to just digging deeper and deeper into this character, and then all through shooting, you know, he just never stopped, you know, it was this discovery, and it was just great too for that experience for myself, you know, that he too so respected the writer, he knew there was a great resource, you know, we would go back and forth on a lot of things, and, you know, and try to tweak stuff or, you know, just, you know, whatever it was, you know, but he's, incredible guy. And I, you know, as objectively as possible, I agree. I think he just embodies Kevorkian in this movie.
Yeah.
I think that's, couple 2 minutes in, and you're no longer watching Al Pacino, you know.
Actually, when I think of Kevorkian now, I see Pacino's face. Since I've seen
right.
that, which is, I guess, the ultimate compliment for an actor. But let me tell you that, I mean, both of these films, Breach and You Don't Know Jack, they're both just exceptional, and you're on a roll, and I congratulate you, and I thank you for both of these movies, too. What's upcoming for you? I see you have a couple of upcoming projects.
A couple other things that I'm working on right now. There's one. One's the story of Reuben Sturman, who most people never heard of, but who in the 50s, and 60s, and 70s was a businessman from Cleveland who turned out to really sort of be the founder of the porn industry as we know it, you know, not as a Larry Flint sort of, you know, type, but you know, a guy who you know, who brought you know, girly magazines over and started the peep shows and, you know, sort of built a, you know, an empire, you know, that, and then, you know, of, you know, I think at one point he was worth $300-400 million and then he died penniless in prison. So it's an amazing story about another very complex male character, you know, that, you know, but you know, terrifically wild ride and journey that this guy was on. And then I'm also doing another true story that's sort of a Boogie Nights type of story called Contingency, which was about the early days, late 70s, early 80s, of when, you know, the personal injury lawyers really started to come into the fold, into the mix, when the lawyers were first allowed to advertise. Mm-hmm. So it takes us back to the beginning of all these, you know, have you been injured in an accident, you know,
right,
commercials
right.
And idea. And it's sort of like, where did that all come from? You know, where was the modern, you know, I sort of call it like, it's like, this is the birth of the modern American lawyer, you know, at the, you know, the late 70s, once this law was passed, the lawyers could advertise. So it's sort of a story about, you know, two personal injury lawyers who go on this, you know, sort of, you know, wild ride of success and then disruption. You know? So those are a couple of things. There's a few other things going on, but definitely mostly what I'm doing is, you know, is more, you know, sort of true story, you know, real people are based on true stories and things like that, which, you know, I think I have found, you know, is somehow always, you know, better and richer and,
yeah,
you know, than things
the
to make
the best
up,
drama
you know,
in real life.
Exactly. So.
Okay. That's Adam Mazur. You Don't Know Jack airs Saturday night, 9 o'clock on HBO. Check it out. It is highly recommended.
Sounds good, man. That was a good interview.
Check it out. What is that from?
That's, I will.
That's from a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's from a movie, and the character and the actor keeps repeating it. Check it out. Check it out. God, I can't. Doesn't that bother
exactly
you when you get?
Yeah, it does. I know exactly. Someone in our chat room probably knows. I'm sure Dean. Maybe Dean knows it. Maybe Patrick knows it. I'm banking on you guys.
Hey, I wanted to ask you a question.
Oh, shit. Okay.
What do you think of Meet Joe Black?
I thought it was 2 hours too long.
It needed to be a short film?
Yeah, it's based on a movie I think is no more than 70 or 80 minutes long. I thought it was too long. I thought everyone was beautiful. It was full of beautiful people, but I just thought it was way too long. If they had really seriously cut an hour out of that movie, I think it would be actually a pretty damn good movie because there are some great lines in it and everything, but it just goes on and on and on. But I don't think, you know, it's one of those films like if Martin Brest had taken his producer's advice and just said, you know, they begged him to like, dude, we can get you the best editor to you know, just trim this down. That's all it really needed because there's some funny lines in there, but it's just too long.
Check it out. Dean knew what it was. It's The Shining. That's
wow,
what it
good
is.
Good for you. Good for you, Dean. More power
it's
to
It's Jack
you.
Nicholson. Go check out the snow cam or something in the radio. He said, check it out. And he's like tickling the door when he's locked in the room. That's what it is. Oh, that's great. Thank you, Dean. It's like such a tremendous relief.
Yes, it is. Now I can sleep better at night now.
Yeah. Meet Joe Black, I watched it again recently, and I revisit it every couple of years.
Well, good for you. That's good.
Good for you. It's, what is this, like a Meet Joe Black support group?
Yeah, it's a Meet Joe Black support group. I mean, it could be worse. I mean, you could be watching something a lot. I mean, it's not the worst. It just sucks because it was like one of those movies that the premise, it's an intriguing idea, but all I remember was like it was really just, it went on and on and on. And I also sat in the front row, too, so that didn't help matters.
It's one of those movies that is... that I find incredibly flawed, and yet I am always so moved by it. And I think it's such a bloated movie. And Cinema Woman here and there is like that too. There's these Mack truck pauses, and it takes forever to get stuff out. And if you cut out all of those unnecessary pauses in the movie, dramatic pauses, you trim half an hour right there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's the ludicrous nature of the of some of the events of the movie and the premise, but that doesn't bother me. It's suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're dealing with the major character's death, so I mean,
yeah,
there's got to be, you know.
But I really like the performances. I like the, as hokey as it is, I like the,
oh yeah,
the message, the movie. I like hokey and sentimental sometimes,
mm-hmm.
And the performances are great. It's the most beautiful movie score of the past 15 years, in my opinion. It's wonderfully shot, and Hopkins just has a way of,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just effortless and authoritative. There's, I think, his best scene, one of his best moments in film, is in Meet Joe Black, and he's standing at the window, and he's talking about his deceased wife, and he's talking about how she used to make like cold lamb sandwiches or something, and he
mm-hmm.
starts to cry. And that's just, it's a surprising moment because you can tell that the moment surprised him when it happened. It just, I could tell it just happened. And it
right,
was this
right.
moment of clarity and honesty that he just reached in that take. And I think Brad Pitt does some great physical comedy in
mm-hmm.
it. Even though I do think it has that embarrassing Haitian scene. But people will bring that up, him doing, like, this Haitian accent, yeah, for a scene, like, for 2 minutes of a three-hour movie, and
right,
you're going to discredit the movie for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
So that's my take on Meet Joe Black. I just thought I'd share it.
No, that's fine. Hey, dude, yeah, bring it up. I mean, bring it up, man. Bring it up.
And the movie has, like, four different endings. Like, it keeps ending. Like, they'll stop when he's taking him over the bridge, and they'll say clever lines together, and then the music will crescendo, then they'll walk a couple more steps, and they'll stop.
Oh, well, doesn't Return of the King have like 11 different endings or something?
Yes. Yeah, it does.
And that won an Oscar, so I mean...
Right. But really, Martin Brest, I don't know. I
it's
don't
still
know.
Better than Geely.
It is, but Geely is, I mean, Geely is a curiosity. It really has to be seen, and it's a bad movie. Is it god-awful? I don't know. I think it's unfocused. I think he was tickling something there, and he didn't find it before he shot it.
Right. I like that tickling something.
Yeah. But that's a fascinating movie. I mean, he just didn't get there. And you can tell, like, some elements are there, and you're like, why didn't you work more? Here's our movie question of the day that we posted on Facebook. What do you think, and this came from a conversation I had with Aaron, because Aaron thinks the most unintentionally laughable sex scene in a film is Meet Joe Black. And I completely disagreed with him. I thought the movie, the sex scene in that movie is character. I mean, and it's kind of a role reversal. You know,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I always thought that was a unique scene about Meet Joe Black. But, oh, another fault of Meet Joe Black. Claire Forlani, like, is there a squintier actress on the planet? All right, here.
A lot, yeah.
It's like the sun is always in her eyes. They needed to hire, like, a Visine crew or something. Movie question of the day. What do you think is the most unintentionally laughable love scene in a movie? Brooke Bartlett says Juliette Binoche and What's-His-Face, maybe Jeremy Irons, and Damage. He kept banging her head so hard on the floor, I kept thinking the film should be called Brain Damage. Jordan, I remember that love scene, and I remember it for a specific reason that I cannot imitate here on the show. Jordan C. Welland said, Watchmen takes the cake. Kelly Queen Collins says, anything with Helen Hunt. She is so cold, you know she has no passion for men. The grossest was Oprah and Danny Glover in Beloved. Oh, please put your clothes back on.
That's funny. I forgot Bobby about
Morgan,
that one.
Right. Bobby Morgan says, Vin Diesel and Asia Argento in XXX, a smoking hot Italian lady, and he acts like he's kissing his aunt.
I don't remember that scene. I don't remember that movie that well. So
I don't either. Apparently, by the love scene, it didn't live up to its title. Sean Newman says the pool scene in Showgirls with Berkeley and what's his face. There's a lot of what's his face going on here.
Yeah, no one knows.
Tom McLaughlin. But actually, when you're watching a sex scene, I mean, you know, it is what's his face. You need to be paying attention to the
line.
John. Ralski, Rousk, something. I think there was something in Lethal Weapon 2, but I barely remember it. That's the Patty.
There you go, folks. There's your
Watchmen was pretty memorable. Also, some people felt that way about the scene in Munich. That's something.
Well, that's
but that's not laughable.
A lot of people felt that way about the.
Some people thought it was offensive, but they didn't find it laughable necessarily. John Elrod says the pool scene in Showgirls. Matches Malone, I wonder if that's a real name, have to agree with Watchmen. The music choice was horrible. I literally laughed out loud when the song started. It completely took me out of the movie. Wasn't it Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen?
So, I think. I'm not positive, but yeah.
One of 50 movies that uses that song? I mean, is that the new, like, Bad to the Bone? Is Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah?
It might very well be.
Jordan C. Welland says, again, for what it's worth, I think the one in Munich works beautifully. It actually has a purpose. Oh, okay.
All right, yeah, go there. I mean,
our good friend Dean Treadway says,
in the chat room right now.
Yes, says definitely Showgirls. But then again, I'm not so sure that that was not supposed to be a comedy. That's true. That whole movie. Ugh. He also says, I find the opening sex scene in Excalibur, well, where Arthur is sired, is a little overwrought.
Yeah, but they wear the armor. That's pretty. I always found that to be very impressive. So.
Yeah. Bjorn Eric Hunland. Showgirls pummels all, and by all accounts, only a few people saw it as a comedy. The rest are backtracking. What else? Conan, maybe.
Oh, Conan where he fucks the witch?
I guess.
Watched it again recently.
Mariska Costeras. Elijah Wood's spaghetti sex scene in the Oxford murders. Dreadful. Oh, the embarrassment.
I think he's just happy anyone saw it.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, no sex scene is complete without noodle. Without a noodle.
That's true. That's true.
Roland Brand. Taken.
Of course. It was
Taken.
What was
I don't even remember. Taken. When Liam tells the singer girl her warm-up was beautiful and asks her advice for his daughter. What?
What the hell is he doing? What's going on? Whatever prescription medication he's on.
Christopher Hurd says, Bruce Willis and Jane March, underwater sex in Color of Night.
Oh, come on. That movie's classic for this ridiculous sex scene.
Yancey Jack Byrne says, I personally love the sex scene in Watchmen. If anyone would listen to the lyrics, it's clear that Hallelujah is about sex and always has been. All those times it was used earlier as a mopey song of broken hearts got it wrong. It's just one of those fanboy lockstep things. Watchmen sex scene sucks, so we say all. So say we all. It's kind of like The Simpsons has sucked for 10 years, so say we all. The distaste for that scene is more about the sound of Leonard Cohen's voice over sex, and that's just ageist.
Okay.
He has some strong thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, wow.
And then you say...
Any scene with me in it is by definition.
Right. I'm shocked that The Accused didn't make the list. All right, we have a 6, 7, 8 number. Sorry, was that a bad joke?
Dean, isn't it the Dean? Or?
Yeah. We're going to get to the closing interview in just a moment. If this is Dean, then...
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Hey. Hey,
what's going on, guys?
How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, bad sex scenes. Boy, there's a lot of them. I think that Color of Night sex scene is actually pretty funny in a way. I think that's kind of a cult movie in a way.
Oh, yeah. It is a big cult movie. I mean...
There's that one scene. This is a scene in an otherwise very good movie that I always hate. But it's real short. It's the scene where the ghost goes down on Dan Aykroyd in Ghostbusters.
Well, thank God it's short.
I think anyone was really. Was
you mean brief? You mean brief, not short? Yeah. I don't want to insult Dan Aykroyd.
Was that supposed to be erotically charged? I mean, I can understand if it was meant to be and it failed to live up. I don't think anyone was really taking that seriously.
The scene where the Green Ghost had all the wieners in its mouth in the hot dog cart.
That was the worst blowjob sequence ever.
Here's a really Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck, yes.
Howard the Duck?
Howard the Duck with Leia Thompson and Howard the Duck in bed together.
Right. Yeah, but is there any way not to make that awful?
Yeah, I mean...
No, it's impossible, but those are some, it's funny, cause, you know, it's difficult, you know, to differentiate from what you think is a bad sex scene and what you think is just an offensive sex scene, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, some people might say that, you know, the scene in the Irreversible
right.
would be a bad sex scene, but I don't think it is, you know. I mean, it's
well,
it's
yeah.
for what
it
does.
Its purpose, I think.
Yeah.
It does serve its purpose, but it's not, it's certainly not for titillation.
No, but
yeah.
I don't think it is. I mean, as you said,
yeah.
it's not.
That's why you can't call it a good sex scene, or you won't be invited any more parties.
Yeah, really. I mean, if you say, hey, that's my favorite sex scene. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, we got to go, man. Sorry.
Well, a lot of people hated the sex scene in Eyes Wide Shut. What do you guys think about that?
Well, there wasn't a sex scene.
Well, there was the orgy scene.
Oh,
you know.
Right.
There
right.
was the orgy scene, which when we saw it stateside was marred by you know, the digital inclusion of people
right.
standing in front of the sex act.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure I buy into that being like a detriment one way or another to the scene.
I think you know, with Eyes Wide Shut, there was just so much, you know, people were so ready to get titillated by Eyes Wide Shut, and then they were completely blindsided by the fact that it was, you know, basically a movie that takes place all in the hero's head, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I
love Eyes Wide Shut. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's a great movie. And I don't understand why.
What do you think is the best movie ever about sex, Dean?
The best movie ever about sex? That's a really, really good question.
Or that has sex as a major component.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite movies, I wouldn't say is a major component, but there's so much going on, and it's Breaking the Waves.
Breaking the Waves, okay.
Yeah, that's a good, interesting choice.
Yeah, you know, there's so much else going on in it, because it's also about, you know, God and not just sex, but love as well, and faith and everything. But that's the first one that pops into my mind, but there must be others. I'm not prepared, right, really, but I would not say The Last Tango in Paris. Some people
What? That would be my choice. Come on, Dean.
Really, that's your choice?
That's the kind of sex I like to have.
Well...
That was a documentary, Dean.
I kind of like The Dreamers as a.
The Dreamers is interesting. Yeah,
I like the Dreamers as a film a lot, actually.
Yeah, I would go with that. I kind of like that movie better than Last Tango, with the exception, of course, of you know, Brando's performance, which is brilliant.
Right, which dominates the entire film, and he's right.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I don't like the movie as much. I don't like the movie as much. You know, it's funny because I kind of get to this point where I'm like, is it the movie that you like, or is it the performance that you like? You know, sometimes
that's
those things
point,
are hard
yeah.
to figure out. You know, and
yeah, I mean, I think that those are they're so intertwined. I think that one brought out the other. The movie,
yeah.
The movie is about. The movie is actually about Brando in a large way. It's about what he brings to it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know. Now you could argue that the other half of the movie, the naive girl and her filmmaking fiance, doesn't come off because the thrust of it is the Brando relationship.
I think that's the thing that weakens the movie, actually.
Yeah.
And plus, I don't think that Maria Schneider is quite up to par for that performance by Brando. But my favorite sex scene of all time, though, is Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland in Nicholas Rogue's book now.
Mm-hmm. Now that's usually in the books is like the defining sex scene.
I would say that changed things.
Yeah.
That was a sea change in sex scenes. But I also like I'm a big fan of the Brown Bunny.
I bet
Who isn't
the Brown Bunny?
Who isn't
I mean,
I feel so sorry for him in that movie. He is in so much pain and agony, and the chick from Kids, you know, Chloe Sevigny, she comes and, you know, God bless her. You know, that's all I have to say.
I like him a lot in interviews. He's like a fascinating interview, Vincent Gallo.
He's the man. I like him. He was great in Tetro. He was just waiting for him to go fucking ballistic in that movie. But he's just great. He is just so fucking awesome.
Doesn't he have a new movie coming? I think he has a new movie coming out that's going to be at Cannes. But since everybody booed him at Cannes for Brown Bunny, he's putting it out of competition at Cannes, and I can't remember what the name of the movie is, but
he's canning it.
Yeah,
the Prince Albert funny. I mean,
here's another movie question. What is your dream pairing, whether director actor or actor actor, that has not yet happened or has no hope of ever happening?
Well, I put my choice down in there, but mine just came off the top of my head. Just real quickly, I didn't think about it very long, but because you could go on forever about it. But I just put down David Lynch and Divine. You know,
that's a great.
If only Divine had lived, you know, I think David Lynch would have found a place for that actor in his universe. So.
Mm-hmm. Interesting pairings suggested Meryl Streep and Javier Bardem, Paul Thomas Anderson and Robert De Niro, Orson Welles and Brian Dennehy playing Orson Welles, Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman, what? Tina Fey and James L. Brooks.
That's an interesting pairing.
That's good.
I always wanted a Stanley Kubrick, Zac Efron film.
Dude, I can't sleep anymore because I know that will never happen.
It's not going to happen.
I actually ran my car into a telephone pole during the summer because I realized that was never going
to happen. And then your wife came out and beat you with your golf club, right?
No, worse. I can't say what she did with the golf club.
That's a Tiger Woods joke.
Yeah, I know. I realized that. Thank you.
Peter Gelderblum. Pete.
Good man. Good man. Great filmmaker, too, by the way. Makes awesome short films. Really good guy.
I got to check that film out. I'd love to see a nature documentary in which Werner Herzog and David Attenborough take turns as voiceover. First, Attenborough will wax rhapsodic in high BBC English about morning dew and rainbow-colored butterflies. Then decay will set in as Grim Reaper Herzog pours his bleak German accent over images of blood-covered wolves biting the heads off innocent deers.
Holy smokes, man.
That's pretty good.
Writing, by the way.
Wow, man. Pete, you're going above and beyond, my friend. Thank you for that.
I really like Kim. When can I see that?
That has to be done. That's a must.
I mean, I'm going to lobby hard for that, man.
Here's another. We talked about overrated. We talked about overrated, and I named some of the overrated choices that people had.
Yeah,
on the last show, but so we'll keep posting movie questions.
My that was a pretty controversial choice, and then I guess you got some more stuff to do. But I always thought Casablanca was a little overrated.
Casablanca,
which movie?
Casablanca.
No, it still holds up well. I wouldn't. That's not what I would go for overrated.
I guess it's just the whole you know power behind that movie. I kind of feel.
Wait a minute. Here. Wait a minute, Dean. Now you posted something on your Facebook in response to one of our last shows where I complained about. I didn't complain. I just said this: if Citizen Kane has a weakness, it's the screenplay, and that's why very few people mention the screenplay when they talk about that movie.
Well,
let me finish. So in response, you said on your Facebook, this is what's called pissing on the past. So now here you are saying Casablanca is overrated. Defend yourself.
Okay, well, I will say that I'm glad that everybody loves it, and I'm glad that everybody gets a big kick out of it. And it's really
the comments. You don't care that anyway.
So your answer is good
problem.
For you.
It's my problem. It's my problem.
It's your problem. You need a Casablanca support group. Actually, Shelley's bought me the DVD last year, and I actually watched it. I'm so bad with classic films.
You gotta brush up on the classics.
I know. I mean, I don't find it that great either. But truth be told,
you're dragging me over the coals.
You guys should get a room, all right? You guys should get a fucking room.
I find Humphrey Bogart. I really like Humphrey Bogart in it. I was surprised by the sensitivity. You know, this thing happened 60-70 years ago, and here I am surprised by. I was surprised by the sensitivity of the performance. I really liked him in that movie.
Well, I like the love story in it, but I don't really. I'm kind of confused by all the other intrigue that's going on in it. You know, like with.
What's there to be confused about? What are you? Confused?
I don't know. You know, every time I watch it, I don't know what's going on. I just know that there's Rick and Ilsa, and then all the rest of it is just
Hella Beans.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Exactly. I've never heard that before. Okay, can we talk about
I even dug out a Casablanca joke, dude. Aren't you proud of me?
I love you for that. Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know. I'm having a good time. Dean, is there anything else you want to talk about?
I just watched the. Did you guys see the new trailer for the new Robert Duvall, Bill Murray movie?
Get low.
What did you think of
and
that?
And we're talking about sex scenes tonight, so that's perfect.
Yeah.
Get low.
Why are we going to talk about that? From what I know, there's no sex in it. But the hell do I know?
Just the title alone.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, what did you think of the preview? Because I thought the preview looked like it took a good movie and made it look a little cheesy.
Oh, I haven't watched the preview yet, so I don't know.
I thought it was fine. It could be cheesy, but, I don't know that it'll be cheesy. I think you got Duvall, this incredibly authentic person in your lead, and he plays an old coot. I mean, he plays like a eccentric.
So is this a sequel to Wrestling Ernest Hemingway or Secondhand Lions? Which is it?
Well, Wrestling Ernest Hemingway is Cuban.
I would say that it's more of a sequel to something like Tomorrow. You know, you remember that? Have you ever seen that movie Tomorrow, 1972? It's a Joseph Losey movie.
Joseph Losey, yeah, man. He was awesome, man.
Yeah, and he's a guy in the wilderness that finds this lady out in the wilderness, and he takes her into his house, and he can hardly he's all, you know, kind of hermit like and everything, and he falls in love with the lady. And anyway, it seems
story
like
of my
kind
life.
Of a sequel to that, you know. You know, Bill Murray looks good in it, and Sissy Spacek is in it, and I don't know. It looks like a real handsome movie and everything. I mean, it looks like a good movie. I don't like the preview.
It's going to be a charming.
To the production company, tell them, look, I don't like the trailer for your movie. It sucks.
Yeah. It's going to be just like a charming Southern movie. You know?
Yeah.
That's what it's going to be. It's going to be, you know, Robert Duvall's Fried Green Tomatoes. I don't know.
Wow, Fried Green Tomatoes. I like that, right? Robert Duvall.
It's for a limited time only. Robert Duvall's Fried Green Tomatoes, only $2.99. Get it at Cracker Barrel.
Wait, I can get it at Cracker Barrel? Awesome.
That's the perfect place for it.
You know, right next to the pecan log.
Yes.
I want the pecan log.
Pecan log. Oh, that sounds so disgusting.
This conversation is going down the tubes, man.
Well, on the note of the pecan log, I will bid you adieu. And
all right, yeah, thanks, Dean. I'm going to have nightmares tonight about the pecan log.
Yes, please.
All right. We'll continue
Dean,
the show.
You're awesome. Thank you.
We'll have fun continuing to piss on the past, Dean. Thank you.
All right, yeah.
Bye-bye. All right. Let's get to our interview, and then we're going to close the show. Exactly, we're going to close the show with your favorite film score, Jerry.
from the new movie Babies.
Dude, I just have no interest in seeing that movie. I'm sorry. I know I'm like sour grapes, but I've seen that trailer so many times, and I just think there's something so invasive. I mean, those kids are going to be scarred for life.
So, well, you know, it is like the kids have no say in whether or not they're being filmed. So I understand.
Filmed. Why did you have me filmed? I can't. All the kids tease me.
They will end up being drug addicts who rob video stores when they
grow like
up.
It's like a remedial version of those Michael Apted films, you know, the 7-Up series. I mean, it's like a really
right.
I don't know.
That's a girl to take a movie to. That's a movie to take a girl to.
That's the only reason to go to that movie
is
to get laid. I mean, that's the only
and like cut some onions or something, or put like onions in your pocket and put it near your eyes.
You're gonna say something.
During the movie, so she thinks that you're really moved by it. That would be like a master play, man. I mean, that would be great.
That would be an awesome plan. I think and
then you could
throw onto something there, man.
And really, then you could follow. Then you could follow it up with an unintentional, laughable sex scene. All right.
Let's go to this next interview.
Paper Man. It's a good movie. It opens New York and L.A. this Friday. Jeff Daniels, Ryan Reynolds, Lisa Kudrow. I think they're using a quote of mine in one of the ads.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember exactly what I said, but it really is a great kind of a unique, original take on several things. The creative process, for one thing, the loneliness and the need to connect with other people. There you go. There's my ad
quote.
Awesome. The second one I gave them was, it's much better than Cats. But I think that they're going to use the first one.
I think they're going to use the first one, too. I don't think they're going to...
Yeah. But it's written by Michelle and Kieran Mulroney. Kieran is, I think, Dermot's brother. And Kieran and Michelle are married, and they wrote this together. And they're also writing the sequel to Sherlock Holmes together with Guy Ritchie, and they talk about that a little bit at the end of the interview. So here they are talking about Paper Man.
Richard, how many times, huh? How many times? I'm going to go through these ballet lessons alone.
Do not mock me.
I'm going to, like, go through the college years, like, alone.
Okay,
man. You know, I don't need you, Captain. I'm going to resuscitate my half-dead marriage alone. Please,
kindly,
your life.
It. Go it alone.
Gladly. Good day, sir.
A good day.
You just don't like it because I'm on an upswing.
Oh, my God.
I'm curious, either one of you guys can tackle this question about the origins of this project. Where did it come from, and what inspired it?
It actually was inspired by a period of chronic unemployment that we were in, where we had been writing for a while, and then, you know, had hit a really big wall in terms of both creatively, but also kind of, you know, on a business front. And we just kind of dropped out for a while and decided that we would write for ourselves and write something that we kind of could feel good about that wasn't for agents or for the business. And you know, we were experiencing a little bit of the reality of the Jeff Daniels character in our movie, where what was the point? Could we really write anymore? Who cared anyway? Was anyone going to read anything? You know, we were at that point, and so we kind of, that was the initial genesis for starting to write this story.
But the funny thing about it, reaching that point, is that if you do something for, you know, because you love doing it, just because nobody's paying doesn't mean that you necessarily stop. So we kind of kept going through that period, writing our own stuff for our own selves, and this is what came out of it. And it really actually started, this particular script started from a dream that Michelle had. One night she woke up and said, we're going to write this movie. I don't know what it is yet, but there's this guy in it, and there's a superhero in it, and I know that there's an image of the superhero flipping off the guy.
Right.
And it was really, that was the start of it. We sat down and tried to figure out how to make that into a movie. It was,
we sort of worked backwards from that image. So it was
yeah,
what's
interesting to me is the movie, it's got several themes that I connected to, ideas like loneliness and the need to connect to someone outside of yourself. And so I'm curious, do you go in with those kind of particular themes, or do they just kind of gestate in the process of writing it?
in this case, you know, often we do go into things we do with goals of kind of exploring this idea or this theme. I have to honestly say, in Paper Man, we really did kind of just flow, and we just sat, and we didn't really know what was going to come next, what scene was going to follow next. We didn't have an outline or a plan, and you know, we just knew we wanted to explore some kind of grown-up stuff. We were sort of in our, you know, approaching 40 when we wrote it, and we kind of thought, God, I mean, so many of our friends were dealing with, should we have kids or not have kids? Their marriages were in weird places. Their careers had hit walls. And so all of that was kind of around us, and we were living in that kind of very real atmosphere. And so I think some of that ended up seeping in just because it was the experience we were having at the time in our real lives.
Right.
And the funny thing is, we really did sort of set out to write a movie that we thought was a grown-up film. In other words, it was sort of, we thought we'd sort of tackle some big issues. And in the process, because we didn't really know where we were going to end up with it, you know, we wrote a movie about a guy with a superhero imaginary friend and the fascination with big dead chickens, and a lot of strange stuff led us into exploring those things without hopefully sort of knocking you on the nose with them, you know. So it's not, we hope they're in there, but it's not, you know, we never set out to preach any of those ideas to the audience, but to let them sort of find them underneath what we were saying on the surface.
Yeah. And tell me how collaborative writing process works, because it's essentially, I mean, basically it's mostly a solitary kind of job for most people. And what's that chemistry when you two write together?
Well, it's funny.
I mean,
it's still solitary when we do it together.
it just depends. I mean, on this one we were very, very shoulder to shoulder, and kind of we both come from an acting background, so we kind of wound up on this one sort of, you know, riffing out loud with dialogue and just kind of improvising, not in an insane way, but just kind of sort of talking things through very much in the same room. And it came out of a lot of just sort of chatting and conversations. You know, sometimes it's a bit more, here's an outline, you write this, I write this, we split up, we get back together and edit each other's stuff. I mean, it varies, but the Paper Man process was actually very, very sort of intensely collaborative and very kind of in the same room together. And, you know, I mean...
But it does have the... It actually still feels like, and we wrote quite a bit before this, and we've written quite a lot after it, but... Even sort of shoulder to shoulder in a room, you're so sort of focused on the blank page in front of you that it feels still, while we're actively collaborating, it still feels like a sort of a quiet, you know, the personal lonely task. Even when you're sitting next to your wife, it's
you're sitting next to your wife,
probably.
Yeah. Tell me about this cast, because this is a fantastic group of actors. And obviously they're attracted to these characters, which are so well developed by the two of you. What did you have specific people in mind as you were writing, or when you were finished, did you start to brainstorm?
I mean, we always had a very tiny short list of people in our heads for the role of Richard, which Jeff ended up playing, Jeff Daniels, and we, and of course, that list included Jeff. And so when we were lucky enough, really, to get it into his hands, and Jeff is a writer himself and a very good one, and has a lot of respect for sort of the difficulties of that process.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very instant kind of connection for him to the material. And, I mean, he was, you know, a sort of a joy. He sort of got everything so quickly and so easily. It was as if he kind of could read our minds. It was really kind of uncanny. And we had had... Our longest standing cast member was Ryan Reynolds. He was committed to this project for 3 years through ups and downs of financing and different casting situations. And Ryan was very, very loyal to us and to that role, and really kind of wanted to sort of explore that idea of someone who was kind of wearing the outfit but was kind of immobilized because of the psychology of the sort of the person who was his host and his friend. So Ryan stuck with it.
When we first sat down with him to talk about playing Captain Excellent, he'd said, which I think is true, that for quite a few years, the bigger superhero movies, the studio movies, He'd been on lists of people to play various ones of the those characters. He's actually playing the Green Lantern now, as we speak. But he said to us that he'd been approached many, many times to play those characters in the studio films, and had finally found a superhero that he could relate to in Captain Excellent, and was thrilled to sort of make that his first foray. Since then, dare I say, because of Captain Excellent. He's found a comfort zone with it, and he's taken on one of the big ones, and he's going to be brilliant in Green Lantern.
Yeah,
it's,
absolutely amazing.
It's made for him, and he's going to be wonderful in it. But his first sort of step into it was with this character, and he was very sort of interested in playing sort of counter to the sort of strong hero, as much as he looks like the looks like the superhero.
And Lisa came on board. I mean, it was just one of those kind of fortuitous meetings where we sat, and within 1 minute, we just really understood that she got that character, because the character of the wife is, I think, maybe the trickiest one in the movie for me. It certainly was the hardest to write. And you know, she could come off unsympathetic if we're not careful. She has a lot to deal with in terms of the marital situation in the story, and she's the cold water in the story a lot. And, you know, Lisa's so eminently likable and so human and so vulnerable so easily that she kind of played very naturally against all those concerns that we had. And, you know, we felt like we kind of won the lottery being able to get Lisa to participate.
Absolutely. And Emma is a breakout in this movie.
Oh,
she's fantastic.
Crazy good.
She is. That was actually a surprise to us, because when we met Emma, we knew her work from Superbad, and she'd done House Bunnies and some of the broad comic stuff. And
yeah.
She's a brilliant comedian, and she's really, really funny and lighthearted and, the sweetest, woman you'll ever meet. And so we weren't expecting her to have this real depth of emotion that was just, we saw her, and there was this other level to her that the world hasn't yet seen or hadn't seen to this point. And it was, again, it was sort of really a sort of a no-brainer. We were like, wow, that's, there's something there that is so alive, and yet so sort of, she taps into emotion so easily, and she does in this film. We think she did a magnificent job with the character of Abby.
Forgive me if this is a juvenile question, which it very well might be.
We're juvenile people, it's fine.
when I had an imaginary friend when I was younger, and I think most people have. But when you get older and you have an imaginary friend, you're considered a schizophrenic. Was that ever a question for you guys, that was a danger area?
It was. I mean, we certainly never wanted, Richard to seem crazy, because he's really not crazy. And, as we wrote this thing and people sort of read it over the years, it was amazing how many people came out of the woodwork in their 30s and 40s saying that they still had people, or their husbands still had people secretly, or there is this sort of thing that's sometimes ongoing with imaginary friends, and it's just a sort of a coping mechanism for people, no more than that. It's somebody to sort of talk out loud to sometimes, or somebody to just be kind of a sort of bizarre security blanket. Yes, it was a concern, because the last thing we wanted was for Jeff's character to come off like he had some kind of weird split personality situation, which is why we wanted to sort of keep humor in that relationship and be clear that...
And to use that character judiciously, so the guy... judiciously.
And plus, with Jeff Daniels playing the role, I mean, he's so instantly recognizably human and sympathetic that I think it comes across perfectly like you wanted. Before I let you go, tell me about showing your movie to an audience, the screenings that you guys have had, what you guys have learned about your movie from the audiences.
We've had some phenomenal audiences already. We've been very, very lucky, and we can't wait for the release and to sort of really put it out there for anyone who wants popcorn in the movie. We're very excited for that. But to this point, we had a very, very dynamic and exciting screening the opening night of the LA Film Festival with 1,400 people in the audience, which was pretty mind-blowing. And felt such a lot of kind of love and appreciation. People had a lot of very deep questions after the movie about the psychology of our characters and the relationships, and they really seemed to dive into the movie on levels that were really very gratifying. And we also had some wonderful screenings at the Hamptons Film Festival. Same thing with like hour and a half long Q&As and people asking the smartest questions, and really, you know, I mean, I think what we've learned about the movie is, you know, we want to make another one, and, you know, you can always do better. And, you know, we've learned a lot about the movie-making process from the first time out. But I think what we learned about Paper Man is that it sort of seems to speak to some very sort of kind of emotional places in people, you know, about their lives, their relationships, their careers, their self-doubt. One person told us how they sort of left the movie and went to the parking lot and sat in their car alone and cried for 20 minutes because they realized they, you know, had been so lonely in their life. And so,
but on,
you know,
on the flip side of that as well, we sort of set out to make that movie happen where you have a reaction that hopefully is sort of visceral and touches you in a sort of emotional place, but at the same time has some good laughs in it. And the,
yeah.
One of the really gratifying things about the movie is that I think we knew that it would touch an audience, you know, in a certain sense. But the you know, the sort of response that we've had to some of the comic stuff in the movie has been really, really gratifying as well, because it's got laughs, you know, it makes it,
yeah.
It sort of keeps you interested and enjoying, and then sort of finds a way to turn that into hopefully something that makes you feel and think without being you know, dogmatic about it.
I think
gone that way for us.
I think it's a fantastic movie, and you guys have every reason to be proud of it. Sherlock Holmes, the sequel, is it true that you guys are penning the sequel?
Yeah,
we are
right
indeed.
Now, actually. If
wow.
Anyone that we put our computer down for a second, we're going to be murdered now. We are deep in the sequel. It's very, very, very fun. Very fun.
That's a good gig.
It's a good gig. We're glad to be on it, and it's been great to this point. We're working towards what we hope is a movie that goes into production later this year. Not too far distant from now. We're pounding away to get it in and hopefully get it up on its feet.
The first movie was so wonderful, and we just feel very lucky to be involved. And you know, with this group of people are really smart, really cool, really. Love those characters and really, you know, respect the Doyle stories, which we, you know, I grew up with, and it's really just such a blast getting to write those characters and to write on that scale. It's just really, really fun. We like our little movies, but we also have a lot of good times writing for the bigger budgets. It's fun too.
without a superhero anywhere near it.
Yeah.
Except for Robert Downey Jr., who qualifies, I think, in his own way.
Yeah, he's totally a superhero. Through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It just moved.
Well, that's not possible. It's been boiled to death.
Poor little Louis.
Well, don't name it, Richard. I mean, do whatever you want. No, don't name your food.
If only everything in the world could be covered in butter, what a world that would be.
I guess.
What a buttery world.
What a buttery world.
That would be cool.
Paper Man, it opens up in New York and L.A. this Friday. Yeah, look for it. It's good stuff. You know, I just happen to think this is this movie contains like a superhero element of sorts in the Ryan Reynolds character.
Right.
So I am going to save the baby score for Sunday night's show because
okay.
I have
the world internet premiere of the Defender score.
That's right, man, yeah.
And that fits, where Woody Harrelson plays a pretend superhero.
Mm-hmm.
This is an original score by John Rowley. It's from the movie Defender. Sunday night, we have Kevin Pollak, a great conversation that Jerry and I had with Kevin Pollak.
Yeah,
and,
man.
Join
us.
It's going to be a good show. More movie talk. The director of 44 Inch Chest, I believe, will be on that show as well.
Cool.
All right, dude. I will see you Sunday.
All right, Sunday, man. Everyone have a good rest of the week and have a good weekend, and we'll see you Sunday. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, everybody. Here's Defender.